this Brussels Times. Coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Ankara opened the Incirlik airbase to the anti-IS combat efforts last month, while at the same time beginning its own air campaign against Islamic State, as well as the Kurdish separatist group PKK. U.S.-led forces conducted 16 airstrikes in Iraq and 7 in Syria over the weekend. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi announced what he called sweeping political reforms in what's being described as an attempt to stamp out corruption. Edward Duranian reports.
Iraqi state TV read a statement Sunday by Mr. Abadi. The plan eliminates the positions of 3 vice presidents and 3 deputy prime ministers. Spokesman Saad Hadithi told state TV the cabinet outlined the new reform proposal and is sending it to parliament for discussion. The proposal is due to be voted on Tuesday. Edward Duranian, Cairo.
Police in eastern India say a stampede early today outside a Hindu temple killed at least 10 people. Authorities say the incident happened as thousands were taking part in a religious festival in Jharkhand state and rushed toward the temple just after its doors opened. President Obama is brushing off taunts from Iran and political complaints at home about his Iran nuclear agreement. In an interview Sunday on CNN, Mr. Obama dismissed a tweet by Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, which included a depiction of Mr. Obama holding a gun to his own head. The president said, in his words, superpowers don't respond to taunts. This is VOA News. Israel arrested suspected Jewish extremists Sunday in West Bank settlements and placed 2 high-profile radicals under a type of detention, allowing for holding them for 6 months without charges. Police say the raids were linked to recent events in the West Bank, but did not say how many suspects they detained. In Mali, a security source Sunday said at least 9 civilians, including 5 UN workers, were killed in a day-long siege of a hotel in the central town of Savari that ended on Saturday with an attack by soldiers that left 4 attackers dead. There is no claim of responsibility, but it comes amid a string of attacks linked to jihadist groups. The Taliban is claiming responsibility for another deadly suicide car bombing in Afghanistan. Afghan officials say the death toll from the blast is at least 29, most of the dead members of a pro-government militia. Pakistan condemned that attack and another earlier that claimed more than 50 in and near Kabul. Pakistan condemning the attacks and emphasizing the need for peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Ayaz Ghul has more.
Afghans are once again pointing fingers at Pakistan, alleging their neighbor is not preventing the Taliban from using its territory for staging the attacks. Pakistani National Security Advisor Sartaj Aziz has dismissed those charges, saying there are all kinds of militant factions operating in Afghanistan, making it difficult to ascertain who is behind the bloodshed. Senior Pakistani security officials told VOA Sunday that despite attempts by spoilers and detractors in Afghanistan to hamper improved bilateral cooperation, leaders in both countries remain closely engaged to further the reconciliation process. Ayaz Gulf, Islamabad.
Pope Francis called for a global ban on nuclear weapons Sunday as Japan marked the 70th anniversary of the U.S. dropping an atomic bomb on Nagasaki days before the end of World War II. The Pope said the memories of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in early August 1945 remain as a call for nuclear disarmament. In the U.S. Midwest city of Ferguson, Missouri, people gathered Sunday to march and hold a moment of silence to mark the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a white police officer during a street confrontation a year ago. The march began at the site where the unarmed black teenager was shot by Ferguson officer Darren Wilson, who has since resigned from the force. American Pro Football Hall of Famer and longtime broadcaster Frank Gifford has died at the age of 84 from natural causes near his home in New York City. He played his entire 12-year career with the Giants. He was the league's most valuable player in 1956 as the Giants won the league championship. After retirement, Gifford became a sportscaster and worked as play-by-play announcer and later as commentator in ABC's Monday Night Football. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, filling in for James Butte, who will be returning on Wednesday. Today is Monday, August 10th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Ghanaian doctors embark on a strike action after talks with the government falter.
It's surprising to most people and visit that professional doctors who work for the government of Ghana do not have any conditions. I mean, it's absurd, but that is the situation.
Dr. Justice Yankson is the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association. And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is in Uganda for an official state visit.
As much as it's not a major discussion on the street in Kampala, the few people who are able to talk about it who understand the following recent eye-fighting about the profile that Kenyatta is building in the region.
Journalist Charles Mwangia will have more on the Kenyan President's trip to Uganda. Sierra Leone's government loosens some safety measures against Ebola. And Zimbabweans talk about why they prefer to stay in South Africa rather than return home. Those stories, plus Mark Uma's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Ghana, doctors have embarked on an indefinite strike. This after saying the government has failed to give them any condition of service, despite repeated promises from the administration. Dr. Justice Yankson, the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association, told reporter Peter Clotty that the doctors working in government hospitals have withdrawn emergency services after negotiations with officials of the administration faltered.
What we are asking for is conditions of service. It's surprising to most people on this edge that professional doctors who work for the government of Ghana do not have any conditions of service. I mean, it's absurd, but that is the situation. Unfortunately, the medical association, that is the mother association or union for all the doctors in Ghana, has been at this with the government of Ghana for close to 2 decades now. And we've gotten to a point where the doctors are saying enough is enough.
Dr. Yankson, some people have questioned the rationale behind the decision to go on strike at this time when Ghana is basically suffering financially. The economy appeared not to be working well. They had to apply to the IMF for a bailout. And some say that this action by the doctors are politically motivated. What do you say to that?
Unfortunately, the doctors communicated this action long before the government of the day decided to go to the IMF. The decision, as I mentioned earlier on, was first taken 9 months back. It was taken in a part of Ghana called Takrade, the capital city of the western region of Ghana. This was on 9th November 2014. At that time, government had not entered into any negotiations whatsoever with the IMF. Government had every opportunity to resolve this matter. If you look at our labor at that province, what we do, even though we have been described in some quarters as essential service providers, nobody wants to follow the stipulations that the law provides. The law is very, very simple and basic. When it has to do with essential services, issues of this nature will have to be resolved speedily. Unfortunately, we've been at this for over 2 decades, and this is not helping matters. The other thing is that even though people talk about difficult times for Ghana, other public sector agencies within Ghana are enjoying their conditions of service. And when it's about the doctor, everybody says the situation is not good, so you can't have it. And we cannot continue this way.
You've heard comments by some Ghanaians that say that if you are really serious about your demands, then you should come together and resign en masse. That will put more pressure on the government to take appropriate measures. What do you say to such comments?
To be honest with you, we have actually communicated this position to the people of Ghana. We did that as far back as 9th November 2014, and we are still committed to that. The catch here is this. You know, for us, we believe that any patient we admitted before the onset of this action, we owe that patient a duty of care.
Some labor experts I spoke with in Ghana say that your action is illegal and that it's like putting a gun to the head of your opponent to negotiate.
We took an oath to work, yes, but in the very basis of our working relationship with the employer is not right. Then nothing can go on. The employer has not fulfilled his part of the bargain, and he has frustrated the employer's contract. For which reason, nobody can tell us we are holding the gun to the head of the employer.
Dr. Justice Yankson is the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association. He spoke with reporter Peter Cloti from the capital, Accra. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is in Uganda for a three-day state visit. Kenyatta and his host are likely to discuss the latest developments in South Sudan and review the situation in Burundi, where President Yoweri Museveni acted as mediator on behalf of the East African community. He is also expected to address the Ugandan parliament. Reporter Douglas Mpuga spoke with Ugandan journalist Charles Wangia about the visit.
I'm not sure that ordinary people in Kampala are very much tuned into the visit. Local newspapers, especially the government on the New Vision, carried a lead story about this visit because since Kenyatta was elected president, in Kenya, re-elected president, this is his first state visit. And especially him coming shortly after the visit of U.S. President Barack Obama to Kenya and the discussions around regional issues, the profile and standing of Uhuru Kenyatta is reasonably high in Kampala. So as much as it's not a major discussion on the streets in Kampala, the few people who are able to talk about it who understand are following these things, I'm excited about the profile that Kenyatta is building in the region.
You talk about regional security issues. How high are they on the two presidents' agenda?
My understanding is that this is one of the major issues that's bringing Kenyatta here. Of course, they did have meetings in Addis Ababa when the U.S. President Barack Obama addressed the African Union. So both presidents were in Addis. The major issues for discussion in Kampala, during this meeting in Kampala, one is the problem of South Sudan, which affects both Uganda and Kenya almost in equal measure. There is the problem of what's happening in Burundi. It's a major issue of concern. It's high on the agenda. And of course, one you can't avoid, which is the question of the insurgency in Somalia, where both Uganda and Kenya have troops and are directly affected by threats of terror attacks on their territories by the insurgents in Somalia.
President Kenyatta is also expected to address the Ugandan parliament, and Uganda now is preparing for elections early next year. How do you think he will be received in the Ugandan parliament?
I believe the Ugandan parliament, one, is it's been struggling over the last few weeks to raise enough quorum to pass electoral reform legislation. But both the chief whip, the government chief whip, who is a minister, that is responsible for largely the NRM caucus in parliament, which is the largest, has the largest numbers in parliament. And parliament clerks have been running advertisements and announcements on local media, television, radio, and print, urging members of parliament to come back into parliament so that they can address two things. One, attend the briefing, the address of the Kenyan president, the visiting Kenyan president. Two, pass those critical pieces of legislation. So I expect that even when this is campaign mode, his visit, one, will be very symbolic because we have President Yoweri Museveni, who is his host, who has picked nomination papers for his party, to seek his party's flag to run for another 5-year term that will take his total to 35 years in power. We have the former Prime Minister, Amama Mbabazi, who is also a member of parliament, representing Kinshasa West constituency in parliament, who is challenging President Yoweri Museveni for the presidency of the country. And you have all this campaign going on. So we expect that his visit and his every word will be watched, especially in parliament, very closely to see what he says if he goes the way that Obama went when addressing these African leaders in Addis Ababa a few weeks ago. I think there will be a lot of interest and people will be looking forward to hear what he says and how he says it, given that the control of regional power seems to be shifting. President Jakaya Kikwete in Tanzania is bowing out. So the senior people you have in the East African region, you have President Museveni, who is the most senior. You have Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who is the second most senior. Then you have Kenyatta, who is like the new kid on the block, and Burundi, which is in crisis. It will be interesting to listen to what he says.
That was Ugandan journalist Charles Wangia. He spoke from the capital, Kampala, with reporter Douglas Mpuga. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Today is Monday, August 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. In Sierra Leone, some emergency regulations for the Ebola outbreak have been lifted. They were put into place a year ago to help stop the spread of the disease. For VOA, reporter Kelvin Lewis has the details from the capital, Freetown.
Sierra Leoneans have generally breathed a sigh of relief as President Ernest Bai Koroma announced a relaxation of the public health restrictions, which were meant to curb the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. About a year ago, the president imposed a state of emergency, which gave him extra powers to quarantine people suspected of having made contact with the virus. The president had also banned all public gatherings or meetings of people more than a dozen. Schools and colleges, nightclubs and restaurants were also closed, and markets were no longer to open on Sundays. But as the number of Ebola infections came down from 500 a week to single-digit patients nationwide, the president gradually relaxed the then-tight regulations. These were not enough for opposition politicians, who said the emergency regulations were a ploy by the ruling government to clamp down on opposition activities. Restaurant and nightclub owners were crying that they were going bankrupt. The youths were angry they were not allowed to watch English Premiership matches at video clubs, and market women were crying for longer market hours. As the state of emergency expired after its first year on the 6th August, the president on the 7th August imposed a fresh state of emergency, which may last for another year. He, however, lifted some of the Ebola restrictions, like the ban on public gatherings and meetings. Restaurants and nightclubs were now allowed to open, but to adhere to rules about temperature testing and washing of hands. The youths could now watch their Premier League matches and also involving sporting activities. The peace and quiet which used to reign under the restrictions was now shattered, as loud music from bars and nightclubs were now heard all over. The president, however, warned that this does not mean Ebola is over and that the people should remain vigilant. It is not clear how many people will heed that advice. For most people, after sitting at home for a whole year, it was now time again to put on their dancing shoes. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Many people around the world were relieved when news got out about an Ebola vaccine that can be 100% effective. But because of the way the study was done, some people have questioned the results. Now another study, this one with monkeys, shows the same outcome. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
In the Ebola vaccine trial in Guinea, there was no control group that was not given the vaccine, even though most scientific studies have such a group. The focus in Guinea was on saving lives. That's why an animal study by the U.S. National Institutes of Health is so important. Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the Infectious Disease Research Branch of the agency.
It showed that a vaccine that is essentially the vaccine that was used in the trial in Guinea, not only was able to protect in an experimental model in animals from 7 days prior to exposure, protected 100%, and 3 days prior to exposure was partially effective.
Dr. Fauci says the study shows the vaccine would still be effective late in the course of an outbreak when people need it most.
The other thing that was important is that it was able to protect against the multiple variants of the Ebola virus that's circulating.
There are variations for each of the four strains of Ebola virus. This vaccine protects against the Zaire strain of Ebola that has killed more than 11,000 people in West Africa. More people are likely to be infected before the outbreak ends, but so few people have the disease that trials of other Ebola vaccines have stopped. But Dr. Fauci says the research is not likely to stop.
All of us in the public health sector believe that there will be other Ebola outbreaks, and that's the reason why we need to be prepared if we had an effective vaccine available to deploy in the very beginning of this outbreak in West Africa. We likely would have saved a lot of suffering, disease, and death.
There have been 24 outbreaks of Ebola in Africa, none as devastating as this current one. And hopefully, with an effective vaccine, there will never be another one like it. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Millions of Zimbabweans are facing serious problems such as xenophobia in South Africa. Over the years, the diaspora has endured abuse in the hands of locals, including employers, police, and the Department of Immigration. Reporter Benedict Lapo recently spoke to these Zimbabweans to find out why they would risk xenophobic attacks rather than return home.
The term xenophobia scares millions of foreigners, including Zimbabweans living in South Africa. Some of them witnessed the killing of 62 people in 2008 and recent xenophobic attacks that left 7 people dead and thousands homeless. Some South Africans claim that foreigners are grabbing all jobs and operating businesses which are supposed to be for locals. Despite these sad memories, most Zimbabweans have vowed to stay put in South Africa, saying there is no democracy in their homeland. Dumisani Leya, who has lived in South Africa for many years, says to make matters worse, the Zimbabwean economy is almost collapsing.
Dying from xenophobia is a better way of dying than dying at the hands of the Zimbabwean government. Death has never stopped people from seeking a better life, because they are looking for better economic opportunities. So the solution to the whole thing of Zimbabweans coming to South Africa is by improving the economic situation in Zimbabwe.
Hundreds of Zimbabweans left South Africa following xenophobic attacks in 2008 and sometime this year. Arnold Ngala says the majority of his colleagues who fled the attacks are now back in South Africa.
When they go back, they find that the situation is still the same. It's still unstable. So they see themselves again, coming back again to South Africa. So even if there can be 2 million people that can be killed, and 2 million can go back to Zimbabwe, as long as the situation does not change, the same 2 million are going to come and risk being killed this side, because there is a higher opportunity of living this side than on the other side of the board.
Ngala says lack of jobs and general freedom will force them to stay in South Africa.
Even if people go back, it's not like they want to come back to South Africa. But the environment that they found themselves into, the instability of the politics and the instability of the economic situation is forcing them, because people have to survive. So now if people are finding the environment not conducive for them to survive, they are forced naturally, it is a natural thing, to look for greener pastures.
Big Foster Nkomose echoes the same sentiments, noting that their lives entirely depend on Zimbabwe's ruling elite.
They come silently underground because they're running away from government, corruption, and everything. We know there's no clean government, but they need to try. Not even an animal can live there. There's animals that you can't find anymore.
With Zimbabwe now rated by some organizations as one of the world's poorest countries after 35 years of self-rule, most Zimbabweans say only fate will determine their destiny. Reporting in Johannesburg, this is Benedictine Hlapo.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Let's join Mark Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Bill. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Egypt pipped hosts Mali 64-63 to win the Africa Boys Under-16 Basketball Championships in Bamako on Saturday night. Algeria outplayed Angola 45-37 in the bronze medal playoff. Nigeria dismissed Morocco 65-53 in the fifth place playoff as Tunisia beat South Africa 76-67 to place seventh, while Rwanda outplayed Equatorial Guinea 73-56 to place ninth overall. In rugby, hosts Namibia outclassed Kenya 46-13 in a Confederation of African Rugby Division 1A tie in Windhoek on Saturday. Turning to netball, Malawi dismissed Singapore 75-31 as Wales outclassed Zambia 71-44 at the Netball World Cup in Sydney, Australia on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Uganda beat Fiji 61-40. South Africa overpowered Singapore 69-21 as Malawi overwhelmed Sri Lanka 101-18. On Friday, Uganda outclassed Zambia 74-38, while Malawi prevailed over South Africa 58-51. Today, Monday, the preliminary group stage draws to a conclusion when South Africa tackles Sri Lanka, Zambia engage Fiji, and Uganda encounter Wales. In football news, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe pipped Egypt's Smuha 1-0 as Sudan's El Merrekh prevailed over Algerian defending champions Entente Setif 2-0 in mini-league action in the Orange Africa Champions League on Sunday night. Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan pipped Sudan's El Hilal 1-0, while in an all-Algerian encounter, USM Algiers edged Mouloudia El Oulma 1-0. Elsewhere, the Republic of Congo's AC Leopards pipped Egypt's Zamalek by a solitary goal in Dolisi on Sunday night. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel edged Egyptian defending champions El Ahly 1-0, as South Africa's Orlando Pirates dismissed Tunisia's CS Sfaxien 2-0. The match between Malian hosts Stade Malien and Tunisia's Esperance will be concluded in Bamako today, Monday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Bill, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a wonderful day. Before we leave you, let's take a look at more news of interest to Africa. Reuters news agency says Boko Haram gunmen attacked a car carrying six people in Borno State Sunday, killing four. Two survivors fled to the bush. A civilian joint task force said the attack occurred along Damboa Biu Road near the village of Nwajarko Sunday morning. In other Nigeria news, Reuters says President Muhammadu Buhari has ordered ministries to use only government-approved bank accounts to make payments. A government spokesman said the move was an effort to crack down on corruption and to promote transparency. President Buhari has promised to end widespread graft, which he said is behind up to $150 billion stolen from Nigeria's treasury over the past decade. That's it for this Monday, August 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producers Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryock, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, I'm William Eagle in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very fine day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, around the world, the killing of Zimbabwe's beloved Cecil the Lion angered people and highlighted sport hunting in Africa. On Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they examine trophy hunting and what can be done to protect endangered species like lions, elephants, and rhinos. That's next time on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing storytelling. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 1730 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.